Crock lids. A crock may or may not have a lid, or may in fact have two. Lids may be interior lids, which fit inside the crock and rest upon the food being fermented to keep it submerged. Or they may be exterior lids, which cover and enclose the crock. Sometimes crocks are made and sold with fitted lids. Other times people use flat wooden discs or improvise with such common household items as plates or, only as an exterior lid, pot tops. If you fill a crock with vegetables relatively full and then weigh them down, unless you have a very flat, dense weight, the weight will protrude above the top of the crock. In my typical home setup, I place a plate inside the crock atop the vegetables and weigh it down with a 1 gallon jug filled with water. I have also used hardwood discs and rocks as weights. If you use rocks, be sure to use hard, smooth ones that are not limestone, which can dissolve in an acidic environment. It's tempting to make the interior lid as tight a fit as possible, but leave at least a small margin so that if the crock tapers inward, as many do, you won't get your lid wedged inside your crock or risk breaking your crock with it. I've done it. If you make an interior lid out of wood, be sure to leave extra space for the wood to expand in the brine. I wish I had known that the homemade oak lids I made to put inside my crocks would expand so much in the brine that they would sometimes break the crock in two, reflects fermenter Allison Ewald. To cover a crock with a jug sticking out of it, I use a cloth. In summer, when flies are most abundant, I tie a string around the cloth to secure it tightly. Flies landing on your ferments can result in maggots crawling out a few days later. Another approach that I have seen people use successfully, at every scale from small jars to huge barrels, is to fill a plastic bag with water and let that serve as both weight and lid. Gravity forces the water enclosed in the flexible plastic to spread and cover the full surface of the fermenting food, effectively cutting off air access. The bags are much easier to manage and set up and adjust as necessary than trying to use plates and jars filled with water, writes fermentation enthusiast Rick Otten. To avoid water leaking into the ferment and diluting it, use a thick plastic or multiple layers. Some people fill the bag with brine in case it leaks into the vegetables. Functionally, this is an excellent solution. The only drawback is that it brings the food into prolonged contact with plastic. Different crock designs. The cylindrical shape seems to be the most popular crock design in the United States, but in other parts of the world, people work with varied shapes. In Asia, people generally work with crocks in a sort of potbelly shape. The Korean tradition of ceramic fermentation crocks is called onggi. My friend and neighbor, Amy Potter, in Dowelltown, Tennessee, has been making gorgeous crocks of her own design. Amy's crocks are ever so slightly potbellied with two lids. A thick and heavy interior lid that functions as a weight on the ferment, and an outer lid to keep flies out. I've collected and seen many other gorgeous creative crock designs handcrafted by ceramic artisans. To reiterate a point I will make repeatedly throughout this book, there is no single method or vessel or style for fermenting. This is a natural phenomenon that people have harnessed in myriad different ways. Don't be afraid to try a different shape vessel, and don't feel like you need some standard issue shape. Just as the fermentation revival is about reclaiming food in our communities, we have the technology and the talent to produce fermentation vessels in our communities. Collaborate with a potter and improvise, and scavenge. When I find myself in thrift stores, I always peruse the housewares section for potential fermentation vessels, such as food storage canisters, cookie jars, bowls, vases, or crockpots. Do not let lack of a specialized vessel inhibit your fermentation practice. One crock design that has received much attention is the waterlocked moat style, usually imported from Germany, sometimes from Poland or China. These crocks are designed with a moat around the mouth, which you fill with water, and a fitted top that goes into the filled moat. This effectively prevents fresh air from getting into the ferment while allowing pressure to release. The German Harsch brand crocks also come with two semicircular weights for keeping vegetables submerged. This design is very effective for preventing aerobic surface growth. The only disadvantage of this design is that it is only effective at preventing mold if you leave the crock sealed, and you defeat its purpose if you open the crock repeatedly to look, smell, or taste, which I really like to do. No engineered solution is perfect. Each design has its benefits and drawbacks. Metal vessels. In general, it is best to avoid fermenting in metallic containers, at least for the acidic ferments. The reason is that the acids, as well as the salt typically used in many of the acidic ferments, corrode metals, and the corrosion goes into the food. Theoretically, stainless steel resists corrosion. Stainless steel vessels manufactured for the wine industry are being used by some commercial enterprises for fermenting vegetables without corrosion. However, it is important to understand that unlike the industrial-grade solid stainless steel used in specialized products such as this, most household stainless steel has just a thin stainless coating, and corrosion can occur anywhere it gets scratched. You can serve ferments in metal or store them for short periods, but it is best to avoid metal for the prolonged contact typically required of a fermentation vessel. Enameled pots are another story, as the enamel protects the metal from corrosion. Check carefully for nicks in the enamel. If unblemished, these may safely be used as fermentation vessels. Plastic vessels. Plastic, a material embodiment of our time, can be functionally effective for fermentation, but it also has its drawbacks. Prime among the disadvantages of plastic vessels are the chemicals that may leach from the plastic into your fermenting food or beverage. The known chemicals of greatest concern that leach from plastics into food are endocrine-disrupting phthalates, which have been linked to incomplete virilization in male rodents exposed to them as fetuses, and to problems in male reproductive development in many species. The journal Environmental Health Perspectives, which reported that polyethylene terephthalate plastic bottles, PET or PETE, number 1, used for water and soft drinks can leach phthalates, summarizes that a growing literature links many of the phthalates with a variety of adverse outcomes, including increased adiposity, fat, and insulin resistance, decreased anogenital distance in male infants, decreased levels of sex hormones, and other consequences for the human reproductive system, both for females and males. A report by the National Toxicity Program of the U.S. National Institutes of Health cautiously concurs, expressing concern that exposure to the phthalate known as DEHP may adversely affect male reproductive tract development. Fetuses and infants are most vulnerable. Ironically, infants exploring the world with their mouths tend to have the greatest exposure, thanks to the fact that DEHP is ubiquitous in the environment, via flooring, building materials, cosmetics, perfumes, hairsprays, and other everyday products. But most human exposure is via foods and beverages that have been in plastic containers. Fortunately, the food-grade 5-gallon buckets I've most often seen used as fermentation vessels, previously having contained cooking oil, mayonnaise, pickles, and other bulk supplies for food service establishments, are high-density polyethylene, HDPE, number 2, which does not contain phthalates or bisphenol A, BPA, another plastic chemical of concern. Nonetheless, other chemicals may be migrating into food from the HDPE. Who knows? Generally, I don't use plastic as a primary fermentation vessel, although I do sometimes pack my finished ferments in plastic. I collect the barrel-shaped, gallon-sized plastic barrels in which olives are often imported to reuse as leak-resistant vessels for traveling with sauerkraut or other ferments. The plastic that I use that is of the greatest concern is the reuse of number 1 water and soft drink bottles. The Environmental Health Perspective study found that the concentration of phthalates in the contents of PET bottles varies as a function of the contents of the bottle, with phthalates leaching into lower pH products such as soda and vinegar more readily than into bottled water. Furthermore, National Geographic's Green Guide reports that although PET is a safe plastic if used only once, as number 1 bottles are reused, as they commonly are, they can leach chemicals, although they do not specifically identify phthalates. I frequently reuse 1 to 3 liter plastic soda bottles and fill them with partially fermented beverages I wish to carbonate. Sometimes I'll bottle most of a batch in glass, but use 1 plastic bottle, just to gauge how pressurized the bottle becomes by feeling how the plastic yields, or doesn't, when I press it. This enables me to know when the ferment is adequately carbonated, at which point I can refrigerate it to slow continued fermentation. Unchecked carbonation can result in dangerous explosions. How do you weigh potential developmental problems in fetuses and infants against the danger of glass bottles exploding in your face? It depends upon your situation. As someone who is not pregnant or living with an infant, I sometimes opt for the practical benefits of storing ferments in recycled plastic containers. If I were pregnant, trying to get pregnant, or living with an infant, I would probably risk the exploding bottles and stay away from the plastics, or just enjoy easy, safe, non-carbonated beverages. Wooden vessels. For large-scale fermentation, wooden barrels make excellent vessels. The barrel I use, which I acquired from the Jack Daniel's distillery for $75, was originally used to age whiskey and has a capacity of approximately 55 gallons or 200 liters. I use it for radish kraut, and it takes about 440 pounds or 200 kilograms of vegetables to fill it. When I bought the barrel, it had only a single small hole, called a bung, in its side. For it to be useful for fermenting kraut, I had to cut out one of the ends and plug the bung. I found a tapered wooden bung plug, which works perfectly via the internet. A skilled or determined woodworker could easily fashion an appropriately shaped plug. I use the barrel exactly as I use a crock. After it is filled, I place two semicircular hardwood boards on the surface of the vegetables. Then I weigh them down using either two jugs of water, one on each board, or a crock filled with water. Finally, I cover the whole setup with a cloth. Wood grains definitely harbor microbes, but lactic acid bacteria on all vegetables easily dominate the protected environment under the brine. During the long, slow winter fermentation, surface molds develop. I skim off and discard, along with any discolored or mushy vegetables at the exposed edges, and the vegetables protected under the brine remain fine. As I harvest the kraut through the winter and spring, the exposed, moist wooden sides of the barrel mold completely, and I always have to compost the exposed edges of the radish kraut. Even so, the kraut protected under the brine is appealing and delicious, month after month. Canoa. Another type of wooden vessel used for fermenting alcoholic beverages is a canoa. This is a hollowed-out log, laid on its side like a canoe, the word canoe being derived from canoa. The hollow log fermentation container, known as a canoa, is always situated to the east of the God House, reports ethnobotanist William Litzinger. Before the first measure of water is poured into the canoa, it is carefully inspected for obvious cracks and holes. Sometimes small wood-boring insect larvae will make holes in the canoa. These holes are plugged using spines from a low palm that grows in the forest understory. If the holes are too large to be plugged with palm spines, or if there are splits in the canoa from drying, the cavities are filled with resin collected either from the copal tree or from pine, which grow at higher elevations directly to the south of Naha. The resin is applied by placing small pieces of it over the area to be patched and igniting it with a match so it will burn and melt into the cavity. The desire for alcoholic beverages has inspired incredible creativity and inventiveness. Gourds and other fruits as fermentation vessels. Before there were glass jars or any pottery vessels, there were gourds. Gourds have been used as fermentation vessels for thousands of years by many cultures around the world. To hold water or ferments, gourds must be dried, opened, cleaned, and waxed. They may be left outside in the elements to dry, or dried faster in an indoor heated space. Sometimes gourds dried outdoors exhibit exquisitely beautiful mold patterns. Mother Nature is the best artist, says my gourdist friend Jai Sharanda, quoting our mutual friend Dan Harlow, who grows gourds for his Vermont farm stand. As it dries, the gourd's outer skin may or may not peel off. The gourd is dry when it feels hollow, and the seeds inside rattle when you shake it. Then you can open and condition your gourd. You need to create an opening in your gourd large enough to fit your hand inside. Some gourds have thin enough skins that you can cut through them with a knife or box cutter. With others, you may need to use tools such as a tiny Dremel saw blade or drill small holes to perforate the opening, then smooth the edges with a knife and sandpaper. Remove the seeds, which you can replant, and any loose flesh. Then smooth the inside as best you can by scraping and sanding. Finally, melt beeswax and rub it into the interior surface. Test the gourd with water to make sure it doesn't leak. If it does, dry and apply more wax. I have also made short-term sauerkrauts and kimchis in a variety of large fruits and vegetables, including watermelon, pumpkin, and eggplant. These are fun and dramatic presentations for the ferments, but as vessels they are far from ideal because they deteriorate rapidly, fermenting themselves and thereby losing the ability to hold liquids. Baskets. Although I have never seen it done, there are references in the literature to fermentation in tightly woven baskets. Anthropologist Henry Brueman, who studied indigenous ferments of Mexico, cites a 16th century Spaniard's report from central Mexico. They have no vessels of pottery or wood, but only a sort which they make of fiber so closely woven that it will hold water. In these, they make the wine. Perhaps beeswax or some plant resin is applied to seal the tightly woven basket. Pit fermentation. I have no personal experience with fermenting in pits, but in the interest in creating a compendium of cultural information relevant to the fermentation arts, I think it is important to mention that simple holes dug into the earth have also been used as fermentation vessels. I have already referred to fish fermented in pits in Arctic regions. In the Himalayas, gundruk and sinki, fermented greens and radishes, are traditionally prepared in pits 2 to 3 feet, up to 1 meter, in both diameter and depth. The pit is cleaned, plastered with mud, and warmed by burning. After removal of the ashes, the pit is lined with bamboo sheaths and paddy straw. The pit is filled with radishes, then covered with dry leaves that are weighted down by heavy planks or stones. The top of the pit is plastered with mud and left to ferment. In the mountainous Austrian region of Styria, whole cabbages have historically been buried in pits without salt in a process known as Grubenkraut. A slow food presidium, seeking to revive the practice, describes the process. The pits varied in shape, round, oval, square, and could be lined with stone or larch wood. The pits were required to be of a significant depth, around 4 meters, and the cabbages had to be arranged in a certain fashion in the bottom of the pit to ensure they would not freeze. The bottom of the pit was first covered with straw, traditionally it was cumin-scented straw, then a layer of cabbage leaves, and then the whole heads of cabbage, turned down and stacked in layers. The cabbages were covered with a wool cloth and topped with more straw, and the pit was closed with a wooden lid, weighed down by large stones, at least 100 kilograms. Before being placed in the pit, the cabbages were blanched in boiling water for several minutes in a large iron pot. This process would change the leaf color from green to white and had several functions: to sterilize the cabbages, to help the cabbage expand a little, and to facilitate the start of fermentation. When removed from the pit, each cabbage, whose volume reduces by half during fermentation, is stripped of its outer leaves, washed, and sliced finely. Similarly, in Poland, reportedly into the 20th century, it was customary to pickle cabbages in special ditches, which had their sides covered by wooden planks, reports ethnologist Anna Kowalska-Lewicka. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization reports that in the South Pacific and other tropical regions, pit fermentations are an ancient method of preserving starchy vegetables, and continues, "Root crops and bananas are peeled before being placed in the pit, while breadfruit are scraped and pierced. Food is left to ferment for 3 to 6 weeks, after which time it becomes soft, has a strong odor, and a paste-like consistency. During fermentation, carbon dioxide builds up in the pit, creating an anaerobic atmosphere. As a result of bacterial activity, the temperature rises much higher than the ambient temperature. The pH of the fruit within the pit decreases from 6.7 to 3.7 within about 4 weeks. The fermented paste can be left in the pit and removed as required." Keith Steinkraus et al. Report that foods preserved in pits can last for months or years without deterioration, serving as a reserve to prevent famine in time of drought, warfare, and hurricanes, and as food for seafaring expeditions. They further describe South Pacific pit preparation. The type of soil and its drainage are important considerations in the selection of a pit site. The sides of the pit have to be firm so that soil does not fall into the pit. To that objective, the sides of the pit may be pounded or the pit may be lined with stones. A family pit may be 0.6 to 1.5 meters deep and 1.2 to 2 meters wide and hold 5 or more breadfruit. Community pits may hold 1,000 breadfruit. The pit is lined with dried banana leaves, and then the green banana leaves are folded and arranged in a circular manner with their sides overlapping and extending above the pit. At least 2 or 3 layers of banana leaves are necessary to prevent contamination with soil. The washed food is then placed in the pit, the green banana leaves are folded over the food, additional dried banana leaves are added to the top, and then stones are placed on the top of the pit. Do not allow lack of an ideal vessel to limit your fermentation practice. Take inspiration from these ancient pit fermentation traditions from geographically disparate locations, and don't be afraid to improvise. Pickle presses. Pickle presses are mechanical devices designed to press vegetables in order to force the juices out of them, and then keep them submerged. I have seen Japanese-manufactured plastic ones and have heard of presses fitted to barrels for making sauerkraut. When I searched the words kraut press online, all I could find was a patent granted in 1921 to Ignaz Glanschnig for new and useful improvements in kraut presses. Personally, I am quite content with the lower-tech methods of weighing down vegetables described earlier, but I do find human ingenuity to be infinitely fascinating, and these are clever inventions created for fermentation. Vegetable shredding devices. You do not need to buy any special device to chop vegetables for fermentation. A knife is perfectly adequate and may be supplemented by a hand grater. Of course, you may use any shredding device you like, including food processors and mandolins. I have a kraut board, which I like to use for large batches. This is a large wooden board with 3 diagonal blades parallel to one another. With each slide of the cabbage or other vegetables over the blades, they shred 3 thin slices. Once you get a good rhythm going, it shreds vegetables very quickly, but watch your fingers. After watching a series of helpers injure themselves, I got a stainless steel mesh glove to use it more safely. For large-scale production, continuous feed food processors can be invaluable, and there are also specialized industrial machines for shredding cabbage. Pounding tools. When fermenting vegetables, it's helpful to bruise vegetables and break down cell walls to release the vegetable juices. At a small scale, I recommend squeezing vegetables with your hands in a bowl to accomplish this. If you produce large or frequent batches, you will want some sort of tool. Any sturdy, blunt wooden object will do, such as a baseball bat or 2x4 board. An Oregon chapter of the fermentation-positive Weston A. Price Foundation is handcrafting and selling a wooden tool they call the Kraut Pounder. Strategic storage of ferments. Keep protecting ferments from air after fermentation. Even if I ferment vegetables or miso in crocks, I transfer it to jars to share and keep in the kitchen to eat from. Once the jar is half empty, it's half full of air. In warm weather especially, but even in the fridge, the ferment becomes increasingly vulnerable to molds when there is more air in the jar. So when your jar gets to the half-empty point, move its contents into a smaller jar that will now be full and devoid of significant air to feed mold growth. Alcohol-making vessels and airlocks. There is much information and much equipment available for home alcohol makers. Some of it can be used to create downright sublime beverages. However, I like to continually remind myself of how well people have provided themselves with meads and wines and beers without a lot of the technology now available. You can ferment alcohol with nothing beyond what has already been discussed. A jar or crock or gourd, along with honey and water, will suffice. Alcohol fermentation typically gets vigorous at first, actively bubbling and foaming. But as fermentation slows, while the sugars are only partially converted into alcohol, bubbling subsides and the surface of the ferment becomes vulnerable to the growth of acetobacter, bacteria that convert alcohol to acetic acid, vinegar. Historically, and still in many places to this day, alcoholic beverages have often been drunk only partially fermented, lightly alcoholic, still sweet, and sometimes sour. Acetobacter needs oxygen and begins growing on the surface of the beverage where liquid meets air. to ferment to dryness, converting all the sugars to alcohol, especially with slow honey and fruit-based ferments, as opposed to faster grain-based ones, minimizing surface area and blocking access to air helps avoid souring. A carboy is a jug-shaped fermentation vessel with a narrow neck. By filling it to the narrow neck, you minimize the surface area of your ferment exposed to air. The reason you can't just plug the mouth of the carboy is that the fermentation, even in its slower phase, still produces CO2 that will build pressure until the plug shoots out or the vessel explodes. An airlock is a plastic contraption that enables pressure to release from the carboy while protecting it from the flow of oxygen-rich air outside. These are made in a few different designs, each requiring the addition of water, which blocks the airflow, but CO2 pressure from fermentation can push through the water to be released. You can find airlocks at beer and wine-making supply shops. If you can't find one locally, the internet is full of them. Airlocks cost just a couple of dollars and are used in tandem with special corks. The cork, typically rubber, should fit snugly in the mouth of the jug or carboy. It has a smaller hole for the airlock itself, which needs to be filled, usually to a marked level, with water. Because water can evaporate over time, if you leave a ferment in a carboy for more than a month or so, periodically check the water level in the airlock and add water as necessary. In the absence of a manufactured airlock, there are a few ways you can create your own. The easiest method is to fit a balloon or condom on the fermentation vessel. Pressure will blow it up, and once it expands beyond a certain point, it will typically leak slowly rather than explode. But keep an eye on it, because it could explode or be forced off. If you have some thin plastic tubing, you can also make an easy airlock. Find or create a cork that fits your vessel, and drill a hole in it to accommodate the tube. Insert the tube into the cork and run it into a container holding water. Pressurized CO2 will force itself out as bubbles through the water, but the ferment will be protected from atmospheric air. Alternatively, you can use clay to fashion a stopper around the tube. Beer makers use an additional vessel called a lauterton, which filters the liquid wort extraction from the grains after mashing. Manufactured lautertons are available from beer-making supply shops, and many homebrew books contain plans for improvisational homemade units. Siphons and racking. Rather than pouring alcoholic ferments from one vessel into another, or into bottles, typically people transfer them by siphoning. The advantage of siphoning is that you can leave behind the sludge of dead yeast, called lees in wines and sake, trub in beers, that accumulates at the bottom of the fermentation vessel. A siphon can be simple, flexible tubing, or that same tubing enhanced by various accessories, such as a firm racking tube, giving you greater control over the position of the siphon in your vessel, and a hose clamp to close and open the siphon. To siphon, I place the vessel from which I wish to siphon on a relatively high surface, then leave it so the sludge, disturbed by moving the vessel, has a chance to settle. Place the receiving vessel on a lower surface, often the floor, and place the siphon so that it is situated in the clearer liquid above the sludge. I always have a glass nearby for a taste while I'm transferring. To start the siphon, I stand up, suck on the hose until I taste the ferment, and then crouch down and let it go into the new vessel. Not everyone approves of this method. One visitor to my website was offended. Just the thought of siphoning wine/beer by mouth is disgusting and unsanitary. When I rack or bottle, I wear a mask and gloves and use a 0.02 micron sterile filter on all openings that can allow air to come into contact with the liquid. You can use a simple, inexpensive pump if sucking on the siphon disgusts you, or if you are bottling in any kind of commercial operation. Racking is simply siphoning the ferment from one vessel into another. Typically during a long wine or mead fermentation, people like to rack the ferment primarily in order to leave behind the lees. The lees are edible and nutritious, but we have developed a cultural preference for clarified beverages, and many people prefer to minimize the yeasty flavor the lees impart. The aeration of the siphoning can also restart a fermentation that appears to be stuck. After you rack a ferment and leave behind the lees, along with some of the ferment, you will have less of the ferment and thus an emptier vessel with more airspace. I typically add extra honey water or sugar water, mixed in the same proportion I started with, to make up the difference, so the surface area of the ferment in the vessel continues to be minimized. Bottles and bottling. If you do not wish to age or carbonate your fermented beverage, you can serve it right out of the fermentation vessel. This is the low-tech way, how most indigenous cultures do it. But often, people prefer to transfer their ferments to bottles for storage, serving, and aging. The first consideration in bottling is which type of bottle. Wine bottles are corked but cannot hold much pressure. Beer bottles are capped and can hold some pressure, but usually are not used for years-long aging. Champagne bottles are thicker than wine bottles in order to hold more pressure, and typically corks are wired in place for the same reason. You can easily scavenge wine and beer bottles at recycling centers everywhere. You cannot get an airtight seal crimping a cap on a screw-top beer bottle, so forget the screw tops and collect the round, smooth-top beer bottles. For champagne bottles, go scavenging after New Year's. Wine bottles require a corking tool, while beer bottles require a crimping bottle capper apparatus. These can be purchased at wine and beer-making supply shops, with the most basic designs costing around $15, and many more elaborate and more expensive choices. There are plans for building your own capper in the excellent Alaskan Bootlegger's Bible by Leon Kania. Bale-top bottles are another excellent option. These elegant heavy-duty bottles each have a clamp and reusable cap, fitted with a rubber gasket attached. Grolsch beer comes in them, and they are available at beer and winemaking supply shops. What is especially great about these bottles is that they are designed for reuse, and you can seal them without any special tool. If the gaskets wear out or get lost, they are easily replaced. These are the classic bottle types used for fermented beverages. As with crocks, ceramic jugs for holding beverages may be handcrafted. If you are bottling for immediate use or short-term storage, you can also use other random beverage bottles for your fermented beverages, such as liquor bottles, some of which are extremely distinctive, or even plastic soda bottles. No need to be bound by tradition. When bottling, always have enough bottles for your whole batch clean and ready to fill before you start siphoning. Once the siphon is flowing, the whole process can go very quickly. Do it in a place that will be easy to clean up, as spills are common and spilled alcohol is sticky. Be ready to stop the flow with a clamp or by holding your finger over the end of the tube or by crimping the tube. Fill each bottle up to where the neck narrows, leaving just a little airspace. The conventional wisdom in the fermentation literature is to sterilize everything with chemicals, bottles, corks, caps, and siphons. As described earlier, my motto is cleanliness, not sterility. Sterility is a myth, not achievable in our homes, nor desirable. The alcohol, or acidification, is its own protection. So long as it is kept from prolonged access to oxygen, which would spur vinegar production, it will be okay. Wash bottles with dish soap and hot water. Be sure to rinse well. Boil caps or plastic corks. Traditional corks should not be boiled, as it can hasten their disintegration. Instead, boil water, remove from heat, then submerge corks in the near-boiling water. For aging, I would recommend buying new corks. You can reuse intact corks for short-term bottling. The big question in corks is whether to use the traditional cork material from a Mediterranean oak tree, Quercus suber, or ones made of plastic. Many wineries are switching to plastic or screw tops to avoid what is known as cork taint, which can occur when cork molds react with wine, imparting a musty odor. I've worked with both plastic and cork, and I don't have a strong preference. I'm more drawn to natural materials and have not experienced anything I could identify as cork taint, but I'm also not a purist and am not averse to working with plastic when I feel it's appropriate. Rumors that corks come from an endangered tree are untrue. In fact, cork harvesting is not only sustainable, the trees are not killed when cork is harvested and the cork rapidly regenerates, but the cork industry is credited by the World Wildlife Federation with protecting millions of acres of forests in southern Europe and northern Africa that are critical habitats for a number of endangered species. Bottles corked with natural cork should be stored on their sides to keep the corks moist. If they dry out, they may disintegrate. Some avid beer makers avoid bottling altogether by conditioning and serving their beer in kegs rather than bottles. This can save much time and work, but requires its own set of specialized equipment, beyond the scope of my expertise. Hydrometers. Hydrometers are tools for measuring the specific gravity of a solution. Specific gravity is the ratio of the density of the solution to the density of water. The specific gravity of the solution you are about to ferment can tell you its alcohol potential, and the specific gravity of a fermenting solution can tell you whether unfermented sugar, further alcohol potential, remains. That said, I have hardly used hydrometers in my years of mead fermentation. But they are inexpensive and easy to use, and many home fermenters swear by them. Thermometers. Many fermentation processes require maintaining a particular temperature range, or cooling cooked ingredients to some moderate temperature before culturing. While you can train yourself to recognize certain temperatures using your senses, as fermenters have done throughout history, a thermometer is a very helpful tool. I use two different types. One is a simple dial thermometer, available almost anywhere. The other is a digital thermometer with a sensor attached by a cord, designed as a meat thermometer with a readout outside the oven. The corded thermometer is great for monitoring incubation spaces because it enables you to see the temperature inside without opening and thus cooling it. Cider and grape presses. If you have access to large quantities of fruit, particularly apples, pears, and grapes, a well-designed press enables you to get the most out of it. A press generally encompasses a mill or grinder as well as a press. The mill grinds the fruit against a jagged surface, tearing it apart into a pulp. Then you press the pulp, called pomace, using a screw type or hydraulic press. If you buy or create a press, go with heavy-duty materials. Pressing juice from fruit requires force and repetition. Good presses cost hundreds of dollars and therefore would be a great resource for a community to share. One household can own and maintain it and make it available for a fee if necessary or for a share of the juice. This year we had a bumper pear crop, and I helped my friend Spikey press more than 25 gallons, or 100 liters of juice, using our friends Merrill and Gabby's press. They got fresh pear juice and Perry, fermented pear juice, for their neighborliness. You can always improvise. With grapes, you can crush them with your scrubbed feet in a tub, and they are soft enough that you can get a good bit of the juice out of the pulp by an ad hoc press. For apples or pears, you can use an electric juicer, but most household models are not designed for high volumes or continuous use. If you don't have the technology for juicing, there are other ways to work with fruit, such as infusing the fruit flavor in honey water to make a fruity mead, or in sugar water to make country wine. Chapter 4. Grain mills. I use my grain mill to crack beans in two for tempeh, and to crack grains coarsely for porridges and beers, more often than to grind grain into fine flour for baking bread. My grinder is as basic as they come, a roughly $35 model known as a Corona mill. It grinds between two grooved steel plates and was originally designed for grinding cooked corn into masa flour. I have ground grains in it for bread, but it is very hard work. A mill with a larger flywheel, such as the Country Living grain mill, is much more efficient for hand grinding. The people I know who regularly bake multiple loaves of bread from fresh ground flour generally use electric mills. If you have a stone grain mill, do not use it for soybeans, as the oil from the beans will gum up the grinding stones. Steamers. Many of the Asian traditions of growing molds, Chapter 10, and fermenting grain-based alcoholic beverages, Chapter 9, require grains or soybeans to be steamed above water rather than boiled in water. The difference can be significant, especially in terms of growing molds. I have used a number of different steaming systems. Most often, I use stacking bamboo steamers, available at many Asian grocery stores. They work best if you have a pot that they fit upon tightly. Alternatively, they can sit in a wok. The reason I prefer them on a pot is that a pot can hold plenty of water for them to steam for hours, if need be, while a wok must constantly have water added to it, since there is much less volume capacity for water beneath the steamers. With stacking steamers, the bottom steamers get filled with steam before the top steamers, so it is a good idea to shuffle them around a few times through the process to get even steaming. Another steaming option, particularly helpful in the case of soybeans, which otherwise take 5 to 6 hours to cook, is to steam in a pressure cooker. Some pressure cookers come equipped with a hanging steamer basket. I've improvised in a big canning steamer by placing an upside-down colander in the water in the bottom of the pressure cooker, and placing another colander containing the soybeans on top of that. Incubation chambers. Incubation involves keeping an environment warm so as to encourage development that requires a particular temperature range. This is what a hen does by sitting on her eggs, or what a hospital does for premature babies. Certain ferments require maintaining an environment warmer than normal ambient temperatures. Historically, people have incubated these near heat sources, wrapped in blankets, or even by taking them to bed and using the body to keep them warm. The history of fermentation consists of clever improvisation to simulate some observed condition. With simple household technologies available to us in the 21st century, we can easily create effective incubation chambers. In creating incubation chambers, it is important to understand that some of the ferments requiring incubation also require airflow, whereas others do not. Aerobic molds are covered in Chapter 10. Incubation for ferments not requiring air, such as yogurt and amazake, is simpler because minimizing airflow is, in itself, a means of maintaining temperature. The way I usually incubate these ferments is in an insulated cooler, which in this case is used as an insulated warmer. Insulated coolers come in many different shapes and sizes. The smallest one you can find that will fit your ferment will be most effective at maintaining the desired temperature. Often I will ferment yogurt or amazake in a gallon-sized jar and incubate it inside a round insulated unit designed for serving lemonade or coffee. Other times I ferment these in several quart-sized jars incubated together in a rectangular unit. A related method is to incubate directly in a thermos. The key to incubating in insulated coolers is preheating them. If you put your 110 degrees Fahrenheit or 43 degrees Celsius milk with yogurt starter into a cold cooler, the temperature will quickly drop. If, on the other hand, you add it to a cooler already warmed to the target temperature, it will hold the temperature for hours. I preheat insulated coolers simply by filling them with hot water before I begin final preparations on the ferment, so they heat for at least 15 minutes. Then I pour out the still warm and clean water, reusing it for dishwashing, add the ferments, and close the cooler. If there is extra space inside the insulated chamber, you can fill it with jars of warm water. You can also add insulation by wrapping the whole thing in blankets. Other suitable incubation improvisations include your oven or microwave, turned off, heated simply by an incandescent light bulb or a bottle of hot water, it may need to be propped open, a dehydrator, fermenting on a heating pad, usually with a towel or other buffer from the heat, or fermenting on or near a heat source or vent. Use a thermometer to make sure you are in the target range. Don't feel like you need to go out and buy an incubator. Use tools and objects in your midst, and be creative, like our ancestors were, about how to use them. Curing chambers. Just as certain ferments require warmer than ambient temperatures, others require cooler temperatures for a long, slow curing period. Ferments requiring cave-like curing conditions include cheeses and dry-cured meats. An actual cave, or an effective root cellar that maintains a roughly even earth temperature, is an ideal curing environment. Unfortunately, most people do not have ready access to such spaces. A wine refrigerator, typically calibrated to about 55 degrees Fahrenheit or 13 degrees Celsius, is the easiest option for creating a curing chamber. But a more versatile option is to plug any refrigerator into an external temperature controller. Temperature controllers. Temperature controllers, also known as thermostats, are devices that turn electricity on or off at a set target temperature. If you plug a heat source into it, such as an incandescent light bulb or a space heater, it can maintain a warm temperature by turning the flow of electricity on if the temperature falls below the set value. If you plug a refrigerator into it, it can maintain a cool temperature by turning the flow of electricity on if the temperature rises above the set value. For long periods of curing or incubation, these can be invaluable. The most versatile model I've used, with a long sensor extension and a 0 degrees to 255 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 18 degrees to 124 degrees Celsius temperature range, was the Yet Another Temperature Controller, gifted to me by its designer, fermentation enthusiast, Mikey Sklar. He and his partner have become infatuated with fermentation, he writes. So much so that we developed a gizmo to assist with it, which they sell online. I've worked with two other manufactured models. The Lux Programmable Outlet Thermostat is a good value at approximately $40. Its major limitation is a very short temperature sensor, so it must be placed inside the chamber. The other model I've used and like is a brand called SureStat, which I found at a greenhouse supply website for about $50. Many other thermostats and temperature controllers can easily be adapted with an outlet and sensor by anyone with electrical wiring savvy. Masking tape and markers. Label your ferments. Masking tape and indelible markers are indispensable kitchen tools for the fermentation revivalist. Write what you are fermenting, the date, and the projected date of its completion. A journal for details and observations about your experiments is a wonderful resource too, but marking the jars and crocks themselves is essential.